morning. I want to speak of Joyce's three major works as representing three parts of what was to have been a four-work sequel. He died at the age of 59, quite suddenly, from some kind of intestinal poisoning, and that was the end of the story. And so we don't have the last work, but I have some hints as to what it was to have been, which I'll be able to deal with after we've dealt with Finnegan's Wake tomorrow. The model for Joyce's life was Dante. And the first work that I'm going to deal with, the portrait of the artist as a young man, is the counterpart of Dante's Vita Nuova. Now, the Vita Nuova has to do with Dante's enchantment in Beatrice. It's an anthology of the poems that he wrote in celebration of her as a young poet. And then he brought them together and wrote an introduction to each poem, describing the circumstances that had inspired it, and followed each poem with an aesthetic analysis of its form and the sense of the formal structure. Beatrice died, and in the very middle of the Vita Nuova, we have the poem associated with Beatrice's death. And with that, his attachment to her, or his regard for her, is transferred from her physical to her spiritual presence. So there is a transformation of mood. Now, this device, you might say, of dividing a book precisely in the center for the moment of crisis is one that Joyce took for every one of his works. When you open the portrait of the artist as a young man in the center, you come to a crisis, which I'll be describing later on, which is the real crisis in the spiritual development of the young hero here. You open Ulysses exactly in the center, and you find the crisis there. You open Finnegan's Wake, you can almost just look at the number of pages in the book, divide by two, open at that page, and you'll see what Joyce is giving you. Ulysses takes us through the Inferno and Purgatorio. It is those two. Finnegan's Wake is the earthly paradise at the summit of the Purgatorio. And the last work was certainly to have been the Paradiso. Now, Joyce announces themes already in the portrait, which are developed in Ulysses and further developed and manipulated in Finnegan. And they were to have been brought to a very clear, lucid, simple statement in the last work. The name of the hero is Stephen Dedalus. A Dedalus is the classical patron of the arts. He is the one that built the labyrinth to house the Minotaur, and when himself enclosed in the labyrinth that he had made, and he himself couldn't get out, he and his son Icarus are imprisoned in the labyrinth, he turned his mind to unknown art and created wings of art by which he flew. Now, when you open the portrait of the artist as a young man, this copy, by the way, I bought in Paris back in 1927, and so it's just falling apart a little bit. In the title page here, we see in Latin, et in iotas animum dimittit in artes. And he turns his mind to unknown arts. This is from Ovid's Metamorphoses. It's a direct quote, book 8, line 188. The printer failed to put the second 8 on that, and so for about 40 years, no one could find it except someone who happened to have read the Metamorphoses, which I happen to have done. And so I've written in the extra 8. I think in recent publications, the correct reference is given. But what this refers to is Daedalus about to fly from the imprisonment in Crete to the mainland of Europe. Now, why does Stephen Daedalus start his book with this? Because on wings of art, he is going to fly from the imprisonment in the Crete and labyrinth of Roman Catholic Ireland to the mainland of Europe, out of the imprisonment of the provincial interpretation of the symbols of Christianity to an opened out mythological, universal reading of the sense of these symbols. This is what Joyce intended. Already in the beginning, here in first important work, and what he achieved, as you'll see as we go through this, we're going to take, as Joyce did, the imagery of the Roman Catholic religion in which he was brought up, Irish Catholic, and having been the same thing, I know what I'm talking about, and release you from that, as he released me, into an understanding of the universal sense, the deep human sense, not the anecdotal historical symbolization of the sense of these great universal symbols that come to us through our Christian heritage. The wings of art. Joyce very early defined for himself quite precisely a theory of art. And it is the theory of art that formed the inspiration and structuring order for his entire work. I think there's no question about it. As I said in one of my earlier talks, Thomas Mann himself recognized that Joyce was the greatest novelist of the 20th century. And this theory of art, which he has formulated, and formulated very clearly, I take to be a classic and completely well understood and realized theory of aesthetics. One studies aesthetics and reads this author, that author, the other. It all seems so complicated. Joyce has really put his knife through all that complication and come as he has come to, in every aspect of his work, to a very clean, precise definition. So I thought it would be a good idea to begin by speaking of the vehicle, the art vehicle, by which Joyce flew. What we're dealing with is Joyce's Daedalus flight out of the bondages of the provincial aspects of tradition in which he was brought up, his flight from that to the great grandiose vision of his final revelation. So, now I see a lot of people with pencils and paper, and I think if you just draw a line vertically down the page, and write on one side proper art, and on the other side improper art, you will be able to put all this together when you go home. Joyce begins by, and by the way, this is in the Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, and it starts about two-thirds through the book. He makes a distinction between what he calls proper and improper art. Now, the word proper means belonging to. This is my property. This is proper to me. Improper art is art in the service of something that is not properly the function of art. Joyce takes the word aesthetic in its prime sense, which means having to do with the senses, the actual apprehension moment. And so proper art is going to have to do with the aesthetic experience. Now, Joyce defines proper art as static. It is not moving you to do anything. You are immobilized in what might be called aesthetic arrest. Improper art is kinetic. Kinesis, move. Improper art moves you either with desire or with loathing or fear for the object represented. Consequently, moves you to action. You are not in aesthetic arrest. The whole meaning and sense is not delivered simply in the formal organization. So that's the first point. Art that moves you either with desire or with loathing or fear. That is either toward the object or away from the object. Art that moves you with desire for the object, Joyce calls pornographic. All advertising is pornography. You are thumbing through a magazine and you see a beautiful refrigerator. And standing beside the refrigerator is a beautiful girl showing lovely teeth. And you think, oh, I'd love to have a refrigerator like that. Turn the TV on. Every one of those pieces of junk that's coming through is pornographic art. Art in the service of selling you an object, making you desire it for physical, social, or otherwise use. You see a picture of a lovely old lady and you think, I'd love to have tea with that dear old soul. This is pornography. You go to some ski buff's home and he has photos of ski slopes. And you think, I'd love to go down that slope. That's pornography. You are not simply enchanted by the object that you're beholding. Art that is referring you to other places. This is one of the problems with the portrait art. The definition of a portrait is a picture with something wrong around the mouth. it doesn't look like Susie. But is it anything in itself? Now, when you look at Picasso's portraits, they certainly don't look like anybody you'd like to meet, but you'd like that picture. the picture is formally organized and interesting. Okay. Art that repels you, Joyce calls didactic. All social criticism in the novel is didactic art. And from the time of Zola until day before yesterday, 9/10 of the novelists are what might be called didactic pornographers. They are presenting you a social message, turning you against capitalism or whatnot, and presenting it with pornographic chocolate coating that will hold your interest. Okay, so what then can we say about the static? What are the moments of experience that can be defined here? For this, Joyce goes to Thomas Aquinas. You see, his sources, Dante, Thomas Aquinas, Aristotle, my, how old-fashioned. He goes to Aquinas, and Aquinas speaks of beauty. Beauty is what pleases. That's a good enough definition. There are, for the beauty of an artwork, three moments to be recognized. And the Latin names of these are integritas, consonantia, and claritas. Integritas, wholeness, integrity. Consonantia, harmony, consonance. Claritas, radiance. And now I'm going to try to describe how this works. Let's take any little clutter of objects. I'm going to just take these things here that happen to be on the table. This is just a rearrangement of things. Now, what's going to be in the picture? Integritas. Put a frame around it. And the frame will, let's say, be like this. That frame cuts off that part of the table, this part of the table, this part of this book, and everything outside the frame is other, and everything inside the frame is to be looked at now as one thing. It's not a collection of things. You're not going to have an artwork until once within the frame is one thing, not an assortment. So, integritas, this is one thing. Next, consonantia. Within this one thing, what is important is whether this is here or there. And that's all that matters. The relationship of part to part, part to the whole to each of its parts. And these parts include colors, relationship of colors, forms, intensities of light, and so forth and so on. That's all art is. The instrument of art is rhythm. And this is true in writing, in prose. If you're writing simply to communicate information, the only problem is the length of your sentences, that they shouldn't be too long, so that and the clarity of the organization of the paragraph, so that within the paragraph you're saying what you said you're going to say within the paragraph, and you present a nice, neat thing. But if an aesthetic effect is to be achieved, then the rhythm of the prose counts. The precise selection of words, the way the T's and the B's follow each other along, and all of that counts. And so poets are interested in the sounds of the words. This is why you have rhyme and so forth, the pitches you pass the words, and they mark rhythms and so forth and so on. This is art. Okay, integritas, consonantia, and now comes the mystery. When the rhythm is fortunately achieved or rendered, you are held in aesthetic arrest. This holds you. Radiance, claritas, the picture, you say, aha, this is it. Why is this so? This is the mystery of art. A rhythm out there establishes within you the residence of a corresponding rhythm within, and you are fixed. There's a psychological value here, and that's the mystery. Now, if it is a rhythm and a radiance that does not overwhelm you, we call it beauty. If it is something that so diminishes your ego that you are in a almost transcendent rapture, this is the sublime. And what renders the sublime is immense space or immense power. Very little art handles the sublime. I don't know any. But one can experience the sublime. For instance, one of the intentions of Buddhist monuments and Japanese gardens and so forth is to bring you up, 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 so that the space that you behold becomes vaster and vaster and vaster. And there's a curious experience with the breaking open of a vast space, the diminishment of ego, you get a sense of release and your own inner space opens out. And I have talked with people who have been in middle European cities at the times of American and British saturation bombing, this horrible business, and there you are blown by power, so that experiences of ecstasy can come in these situations. One of the astronauts told me of an experience he had had on one of the flights where he was assigned an extravehicular assignment, what was called an EVA. And there he was in his space suit, attached to the module only by the umbilical. And he was to work in accord with somebody inside the module who was doing some other work that would match what he was doing. Something went wrong inside the module with the machinery, and so he was left for 5 minutes with nothing to do. See, those chaps were kept very busy so that they shouldn't be blown. And here he is with nothing to do for 3 or 4 or 5 minutes. He said, I'm going through space at 18,000 miles a minute or something like that, an hour. There's no wind, there's no sound, and the earth is up there, and the moon is over there. And he said, I asked myself what I had ever done to deserve this experience. That is the sublime. All orientation is blown. I mean, just gone. I don't think any artwork can do that. Integritas, consonantia, claritas. And it doesn't matter what the forms are. These are the basic principles that are analyzed and worked out in what is called non-objective art. That's just the ABCs of art. And you are not moved with desire or with fear or loathing. You are simply held in aesthetic arrest by the beautiful accord. What Joyce calls the rhythm of beauty, which stills the heart. Now what this is a breakthrough. You've gone through the objects, and the kind of transcendence is manifest through them. The transcendence of which you are yourself a manifestation, so that pure object turns you into pure subject. You are just the I, the world I, regarding beyond desire and loathing, just as God beholds the world on the seventh day, you might say. Nothing to do. This is it. Now we come to the next problem in this aesthetic. Suppose we're composing a play or writing a novel in which there is action, in which there are characters, in which there are people who are not lovable, who are, in fact, hateable. What about the desire and loathing situation there? How are we to achieve stasis? Of course, this is something that Joyce is concerned with since he's writing novels. For the formulation here, he turns to Aristotle, Aristotle's Poetics. Now, Aristotle had the misfortune of being preserved, his theories and thoughts being preserved, not out of his own writing, but through the notes of his students. And consequently, it's not always easy to know what Aristotle really meant. Aristotle speaks of the tragic emotions. And there is also the problem of the comic emotions. Now, the comic we're not going to have to be dealing with here. Joyce doesn't mention it in the portrait, but he does in an earlier work, Stephen Hero, which was a first sketch for the portrait, which he never published but became published after his death. The emotion of the comic is joy. Joy in what you are experiencing. There's no desire, there's no loathing, it's just delight. The tragic is something else. The emotions of the tragic are pity and terror. Now, terror is not loathing. This is a fine distinction we have to make. So, let's define pity. Stephen Dedalus says, Aristotle has not defined pity and terror. I have. As follows. Pity is the emotion that arrests the mind, aesthetic arrest, before whatsoever is grave and constant, can't be changed, in human suffering, and unites it with the human sufferer, not with the poor sufferer, the black sufferer, the communist sufferer, unites it with the human sufferer. And we're all human beings, and we are being united to this person as a human being, not as a human being with a certain social character. Pity is the emotion that arrests the mind before whatsoever is grave and constant, cannot be changed in human suffering, and unites it with the human sufferer. Terror, the same definition. Terror is the emotion that arrests the mind before whatsoever is grave and constant in human suffering and unites it with the secret cause. That is the big word here, the secret cause. Now let's take as a problem, Mr. A shoots Mr. B. What is the secret cause of Mr. B's death? Now, what are we writing about? We're writing about the secret cause of Mr. B's death. Is the cause of the death the bullet? That is the instrumental cause. That's not the secret cause. This is a basic philosophical distinction between the secret cause, the formal cause, the instrumental cause. The instrumental cause of Mr. B's death is a bullet, and if that's what we're writing about, then we're writing something about gun control or something like that, a pamphlet on gun control. We're talking about the bullet. But we've got to be talking through the bullet to the secret cause of Mr. B's death. Now, Mr. B is a black man and Mr. A is a white man. So are we talking about racial problems? Then Mr. B is not being looked at as the human sufferer, but as the black sufferer. And you're in a sociological work here. Now, what's the secret cause of the man's death? Now, I'm taking the black and white intentionally with Martin Luther King in mind. And I recall that a couple of weekends before Martin Luther King was killed, he said, "I know I'm challenging death in insisting on this march." This is a man who killed himself, as we all do. This is what is tragic. The mystery of the relationship of a man's life to a man's death. And he becomes a hero insofar as he is fearless in this. He is without the fear or desire, but is in movement in terms of his destiny, which inevitably brings a death. And we're not in a work of art to say, "Oh, this should not have happened." We're in a work of art to say, "This should happen. Hooray, that I too should die this way." Huh? Then you've got a tragic work of art and you're talking about the secret cause. Mortality, that's the big general secret cause. We're all going to die, and how we die is indifferent if what we're talking about is the mystery of dying. But then this becomes something that can be written about as a biography when you see how that mystery of this man's dying was a function of his living. And all life is this way. And this should not be corrected. This cannot be corrected. This is the grave and constant in human suffering. If you don't get through to the constant, then you really haven't got through to a tragic work. And what this does is open to transcendence the experience that's on the stage or in the novel here. Otherwise, it closes and you're in a sociological novel, which is no tragedy. Now, a play that comes to my mind is The Death of a Salesman, which is right on the edge. It can be looked at as a complaint against the way our industrial and merchant system works, or you can look at it as something that is grave and constant, how this man's death and suffering was a function of his own lifestyle and so forth and so on. It's right on the edge. So this is Joyce's vehicle now. Tragedy, pity, and terror. We look through the instrumentality of the operation and experience the secret cause. And the sufferer is not a black man, it's a man. We're going through. Now, in our thinking, in our newspaper reading, in our schools, everywhere, we're so involved now in the sociological that it's very, very difficult to see an event like this in tragic and not sociological terms. Everything Joyce does is has this breakthrough into the transcendent. Now, the next point with respect to his theory of art has to do with literature specifically, and it has to do with the difference between lyric, epic, and dramatic art. Lyric presents the object in immediate relation to the subject. The subject is the one who is the witness. The object is what is witnessed. In the lyric, the object is presented in such a way that it gives expression to the mood of the witness. What a lovely day. I am so happy. This makes me so happy. This is lyric. One of the problems of the lyric is that the subject should open up and become not just Tom, Dick, or Harry, but a vehicle of the cosmic witness and subject. That's what makes lyric poetry so delicately balanced between just egoism and a revelation. Dramatic, it presents the object in immediate relation to the object. The author of the play isn't on the stage saying, "Isn't she wonderful? Now this is going to be this way. This is very sad. This is what this means." All you get is just the object. As Joyce says, the subject, the author, has pulled himself out altogether as God in his world. And yet, every element in the play is of the author's own radiance. Epic presents the object in mediate, in between, mediate relationship to subject and object. That is to say, the work, the object is presented with author's comment. It is carried on the author's emotion and comment and explication and so forth. Now, it's very interesting to me that just about the time that Joyce was working on this aesthetic and presenting it in his novel, Thomas Mann wrote a paper called Über das Theater, about the theater, in which he makes exactly the same distinction between the dramatic and the epic styles. Joyce decides on the dramatic style for his writing. Mann decides deliberately, these young authors, on the epic style. So that when you read Mann's work, for instance, The Magic Mountain, he is giving you the author's comment that lets you know where you are, what's going on, how he feels about it, and so forth. He uses adjectives that say more than just what the object is. Joyce does not do that. And this makes Joyce's writing very, very difficult for some people. Ulysses starts out. You don't know where you are here. Stately, plump Buck Mulligan came from the stairhead, bearing a bowl of lather on which a mirror and a razor lay crossed. A yellow dressing gown ungirdled was sustained gently behind him by the mild morning air. He held the bowl aloft and intoned, "Introibo ad altare Dei." Halted, he peered down the dark winding stairs and called up coarsely, "Come up, Kinch, come up, you fearful Jesuit." Solemnly he came forward and mounted the round gun rest. He faced about and blessed gravely thrice the tower, the surrounding country, and the awaking mountains. Then catching sight of Stephen Dedalus, he bent towards him and made rapid crosses in the air, gurgling in his throat and shaking his head. Stephen Dedalus, displeased and sleepy, leaned his arms on the top of the staircase and, "Where are you, you know?" Well, it takes a little while. And when you've gone through the book 3 or 4 times and know where you are, it's very exciting. Because it's all protein. There's no fat. There's no carbohydrates. You've just got the sheer experience right in front of you, and it is a delight to read it over and over and over. I've never had with any other author that kind of experience. I bought this book in Paris in 1927. It wasn't allowed in the United States at that time. This was smuggled into the United States, my dear friend. I've been reading it ever since, and it's a delight every time. Now, another author whom I rank in the same category with Joyce, Thomas Mann, I would not have the same delight in reading it the 58th time. I really wouldn't. So this is the advantage, this is the disadvantage of Joyce, and this is why, for everything that Joyce has written, we have introductory books. The one for Ulysses, the best one, is Stuart Gilbert, James Joyce's Ulysses. He tells you where you are. He tells you what the relationship of intro ebo ad altare day is to this whole thing. What's happening is Buck Mulligan is on the top of what's known as a Martello Tower. Now, one reader out of 10 million will know what a Martello Tower is. And if you've never been to Ireland, you won't ever know. A Martello Tower is a kind of cylindrical fort that was built at the time of Napoleon, when the British thought Napoleon might try to invade the British Isles. And they built these forts around here and there, and there are two right near to Dublin. Now, when you go into this fort, you enter and you climb a stairway inside, and you come to a circular room. Now, since it's a fort, the walls are about 3 or 4 feet thick, and the windows are tiny little slats that open out. So you're in a realm that's totally removed from the world. And within this tower here, there are three chaps. There is Mulligan, whom we've just seen up on the top. The top is, again, circular, of course, and there's a parapet that runs around it. So he has come out holding his shaving bowl of shaving soap with a mirror on it and a razor, and the yellow dressing gown is sustained behind him. And if you've ever seen a priest come out to recite, to perform the ceremony of the Holy Mass, this is what he's mimicking. Comes out as though he had the chalice with the paten on top of it, with his gown behind him, and he places this on the altar, the parapet, and he says, "Intro ebo ad altare Dei," I go onto the altar of God, and he blesses the countryside and so forth. So the whole book is going to be a mockery of the Mass in some way or other. And we find at the very end here, toward the very end, a black mass being celebrated, actually. And there are moments of crucifixion and all the whole thing, and reception of communion, all the way through, there's this being played. Now, there's a third chap here. There's Mulligan, there's Stephen Dedalus, our hero, and there's a chap who's rooming with them, a British fellow, an Englishman. His name is Haynes. And when they sit down to breakfast, they're going to have fried eggs. And there are 3 fried eggs in the frying pan. You've seen 3 fried eggs in the frying pan. 3 divine personalities and 1 divine substance. This is symbolic of the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. And there's just a clue to let you know that this is what we've got here. When they hack the eggs out of the pan and put it on the plate, they say, I think it's Mulligan, he's the one who's doing all this, in nomine Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sancti, Amen. That's all we know. Mulligan is the father, Stephen is the son, and Haynes, the Englishman, is the Holy Spirit. It's really a very amusing affair. But it's more than amusing. What he is doing is structuring relationships in terms of this archetypal relationship of Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. Well, you need a little help for this kind of thing, and it goes into high when you come to Finnegan's Wake. Now, when I went to Paris, of course, I didn't know that Joyce existed. So we were not allowed to know of the existence of anybody like this. It took Joyce 16 years to get the portrait published. When you read it, you wonder, what in heaven's name stopped the publication of this book? Those were funny days. So I am in Paris, and I see this blue book all around with the great word Ulysses on it. And of course, I think, go in, avez-vous Ulysses? Mais oui, monsieur. So I go home and I start reading. Well, I don't know what I'm reading, but I came finally to a place that just stopped me entirely. Chapter 3, ineluctable modality of the visible, at least that if no more. Signatures of all things I am here to read. I don't know what in heaven's name is this. So I go in wrath to the publisher, who is in Place Lodéon, Shakespeare and Company. And there is Sylvia Beach, this wonderful woman, who, if it weren't for her, we wouldn't have this at all. She's the publisher. And I said, how do you read a thing like this, you know? I was over there studying medieval philology, and what's this got to do with it? Well, she says as follows. So she gives me a lot of books on how to read it, and then, you know, I was hooked. I've been hooked ever since. The great advantage of this kind of writing is that it doesn't give you any help. Once you grab that picture, you've got it intact and pure, and the rhythm of beauty is glorious throughout everything that this man has done. Now, as for the matter of the dramatic, the next aspect of the dramatic. In the first place, he's not going to give you any help. But in the second place, the object is presented in immediate relation to the object. That is to say, Joyce's prose, Joyce's style, is going to be in the style, not of James Joyce at the age of 25 when he's writing, but James Joyce at the age of 1 or 2. The portrait of the artist as a young man opens as follows. Once upon a time, and a very good time it was, there was a moo cow coming down along the road. And this moo cow that was coming down along the road met a nicened little boy named Baby Tuku. His father told him that story. His father looked at him through a glass. He had a hairy face. He was Baby Tuku. The moo cow came down the road where Betty Byrne lived. She sold lemon plat. Oh, the wild rose blossoms on the little green place. He sang that song. That was his song. Oh, the green woth botheth. When you wet the bed, first it is warm, then it gets cold. His mother put on the oil sheet. That had the queer smell. His mother had a nicer smell than his father. She played on the piano the sailor's hornpipe for him to dance. Well, my God. We're in the on the mind level of a very small boy. And the style grows up as the boy grows up. And by the time you get to page 10 or so, you've reached the style that Hemingway adapted for his stories about his boyhood. I mean, actually, it's speaking the truth. Then you get into his college years, and he's writing in the style of Cardinal Newman, and so forth and so on. And so it is as it grows up. Then you come to Ulysses, and the style changes with each chapter in terms of the mood and sense of the situation, also in terms of the time of day and how people feel at the time of day. This that I just read was bright dawn and sparkling, and that whole chapter is quite sparkling. By the time you get toward the end, after everybody's totally drunk and been knocked down in the street and had a hard time, the style is really just, it's the kind of style you get when you're teaching prep school boys how to write. It's full of extra words and roundabout sentences and gosh, you never get on, and so forth. And then the final chapter, which is what most people bought Ulysses for, Molly Bloom's meditation as she's trying to get to sleep after having been waked up by Bloom entering the bed, in which there has been another gentleman all day. The style, it just runs on without a punctuation mark. It's just the stream of her consciousness flowing on. And then everybody goes to sleep, and then comes Finnegan's Wake, which is in the style of dream, where every word, every sentence has five or six meanings. Big Mester Finnegan of the stuttering hand, free men's Maurer, lived in the broadest way imaginable in his rush led too far back for messages, before Joshua and Judges had given us Moses or Helvetius committed Deuteronomy. One yeasty day he sternly struck his tit in a tub for to watch the future of his fates. But ere he swiftly stuck it out again by the might of Moses, the very water was evaporated, and all the Guinnesses had met their exodus. So that ought to show you what a penchantucci chap he was. And during mighty odd years, this man of hard cement and edifices in Topper's Thorpe piled bildung, supra bildung, upon the banks for the livers by the sowing zone. So where are you? Here. And it takes a little while to extract the 98 meanings that are in what I've just given you. So the style of Joyce is one of the miracles, and it becomes more and more delightful as you soak into it and get the sense of what he's doing. Now, that for one major aspect of the art, and now the next. In this portrait of the artist, objects appear, but he's always giving you what the object means for the character in the book. His father had a hairy face, and it's said in such a way that we know what the boy feels about the hairy face, because very next his mother has a different kind of face and so forth. And it's always the boy's relationship to the thing, the feeling tone that is associated with the perceptions. The feeling tone associated with the perceptions. This leads us deeper and deeper into his hero's psyche. Now, since Stephen is brought up a Roman Catholic and is trained, well trained, in the iconography of the church, very soon the feelings begin to move in the way of Catholic thoughts. For example, there's a lovely little girl that this little boy is interested in. And when she runs, her hair, her golden hair, streams out in the sunlight. And he thinks then of the litany to the Virgin, House of Gold. She has lovely long neck and ivory-like skin, Tower of Ivory, House of Gold. And he says, you know, Protestants don't understand these things. But by thinking about them, you come to understand them. And the kid's working this thing out. And then when he gets past his little boyhood up into young manhood and is working on Aquinas and all that, the whole experience begins to be interpreted in terms of the philosophy of the church. So we are interpreting life experience in terms of archetypal systematic thinking as we go on here.
Of a grin, you to be. Come give me the last token between you and me.
Gregory, don't you remember swapped rings off each other's hands, surely against my will. Mine was of the beaten gold, yours but black tin. Yes, mine was of the beaten gold, yours but black tin.
Well, if you be the lass of a grin, as I suppose you to be, come give me the last token between you and me.
Locked in.